Good evening, James McCanny here with my Science Hour, December 20th, 2018, coming up on Christmas Day, Christmas Eve this coming year, and I hope you celebrate it, well, mildly. It's always fun to give and get presents, but the whole reason for Christmas, remember, is Christ's birthday, and the very interesting story, I always love Christmas time, because I think the stories are so rich. And I love the Three Kings story and many other things that go with it. So happy New Year, of course, but more than that, Merry Christmas. Something that this was a Christian country when it founded, and it still is primarily. And that's something that we should hear more of is Merry Christmas. And that the holidays are Christmas holidays, etc. Anyway, a little bit about Comet 46 Wirtanen. I've been talking about this for many weeks. And it was a comet that appears, in fact, some people call it the Christmas comet because it comes around every December. So... and that it was billed to be possibly an eye-visible comet, but as it turns out, it was not. In fact, it just had its closest approach to Earth a few days ago, between the 16th and 17th of December. And you can go online and see some pictures. So it was kind of a, you know, if you had binoculars or it was fun to talk about, it was the brightest comet in the solar system at the time. There are usually many comets, the two avid comet followers. There are usually as many as 10 or 12 comets at a time in the solar system that people are watching and looking at. But this one turned out to be the closest. In fact, the closest of in the top 10 closest comets in history. Well, at least recorded history. There may have been closer ones, and in fact, there probably were much closer ones, given the fact that we had mountain building and all of the activity we see on Earth, which could only be accomplished by close encounters with large passing celestial objects. Okay, this next story is rather interesting. Delta Airlines introducing face recognition to people when they board planes. And from what I understand, this is only in the Atlanta terminal, and it's only for international flights. So apparently, this is the weird part, is they have a database of everybody's face on the planet, so they can recognize you with a camera walking through an airport or whatever. And so all you do is you walk up to this camera, it takes a image of your face or a reading, identifies you, you don't need your passport, you don't need anything, and you get your tickets and go on the plane. But I can see amazing flaws in this. Some people are saying it's only 95% accurate, so there could be people getting on an airplane with your passport information and think the machine thinking it's you, and it's who knows, somebody else. So, and there's going to be other problems in that people will get there thinking they don't need their passport, the system will not be able to identify them, and they're going to be stuck. Or imagine people that are foreigners here in the United States and they're leaving on a foreign plane. And it gets it wrong and thinks they're somebody else. And it, I can just think of all kinds of scenarios. But the strangest part, of course, is the idea that they have installed this. And I saw an advertisement for this. And the guy is going like, oh, gee, isn't this great? You can just walk up and everybody should be really happy about this. Well, not me. And anyway... probably won't have a circumstance to be in Delta's Atlanta airport anytime, you know, maybe in my lifetime. But this is an image of something to come in the future. And of course, the other problem here is the computer systems don't update. I can think of all kinds of examples where people send in, for example, something simple like your driver's license or your automobile registration, and it can take some states up to months to get this back to you. And so it's also true of other documents, etc. So what if you come up, you know, in the future, and all of a sudden the computer, through cross-computer checks or whatever, oh, you have an outstanding traffic ticket in such and such a state. And then you go, well, I paid that. Well, the computer doesn't know it because, not, you know, the bookwork has not been updated in that particular state. So here you are trying to, you know, just get on an airplane. And, you know, and I'll tell you, I have been, I've had experience with people that I know where they've tried to get on airplanes and have been blocked for false reasons. I'll just leave it at that. But this can only lead to problems. And, you know, for maybe 95% of the public, this might work. But I can only see this heading down the road towards other problems or complications. See, now this is just to give you an example what Obamacare was all about, was to get everybody into a national database and then set out mandates that, oh, to qualify for Obamacare, you got to get your flu shot. Well, you don't want a flu shot. You don't want any kind of shots. And the government's going to try and mandate, so then you try and go get on an airplane, and they go, oh, well, you don't have your official government documented flu shot, so you can't get on this airplane. That's where it was going, believe me. So it's great that it was a financial disaster, and they're trying to get rid of it. I understand it's still being, you know, there's still pieces of it around. But a tremendous, tremendous national disaster for the government to try and take over health insurance. Now, something they have no experience in at all, which they've proven. Okay, enough of that. But anyway, Delta Airline with its spiffy new face recognition equipment in the Atlanta airport. Before I go on here, I just want to talk about the MR9 deal that I have on my webpage, where this has been, people have been taking advantage of this. So the MR900 is the biggest of my commercial grade whole house or industrial grade water filter systems. And these are amazing, amazing products. But what happened is I have the MR5, that's the smaller one. That would be plenty big for most people's houses. And then there's also the MR9, which is about twice as big. The flow rate of the MR5 is 5 to 7 gallons per minute, which is a pretty good flow rate. It'll handle the flow rate higher than that, but the maximum filtration of the filter elements, etc., works at 5 to 7 gallons per minute and below. The MR9 runs up to around 9 to 12 gallons per minute, so almost double. And it's basically the same system, just bigger. And at the end, there's a three-part system. The first part is a reduction of sediment filter, and that can be cleaned on a regular basis. Usually you don't have to clean it because most people don't have that much sediment in their water. But if you did, that's the first stage of this filter. Then there's the big housing that you see on the sales page. And that would contain, for the MR5, it would contain five big filter elements. They're the same quality as my gravity filters, take out the same chemicals and everything. And then the last stage is a UV filter, which kills any bacteria and viruses. So this is really an awesome system. But anyway, we ran out of MR5s, and We're going to go to a different housing after Christmas. And so that's all in the works. That's coming. So anyway, what I did, a customer bought the MR5, and I said, gee, you know, we're out of them. I didn't quite realize it. And I said, okay, why don't we do this? I'll give you the MR9 filter, and I'll just charge you $600 more. And so anyway, the description of this sale is on my webpage. I'm not going to waste a lot more time. But anyway, it's, if you purchase the MR5 with the extra replacement kit, it's $2,750. Then I send you an invoice for $600. And instead of the MR5, we send you the MR9. So it's really an amazing deal. And I'll tell you something, the shipping on this thing is included for free. The shipping alone is like $250. Anywhere from $150 to $250 in the USA. So it's a really an amazing deal. You're never going to see anything like this again in the future. So go to my webpage, jmccsci.com, click on the secure web ordering page, scroll down to the whole house filters, and it's all described there. So anyway, I won't mention that again, but I just wanted to get that described here early in the show, because from now on I'll be talking about some science issues. Just a couple quick announcements. The U.S. Space team is coming back from the International Space Station on a Russian spacecraft. The reentry vehicle is Russian. The United States is still using Russian launch systems and recovery reentry systems for our astronauts. And at any day, Russia could say, hey, no, hey, boys, no more. And NASA would be literally grounded because they have no capability of sending men into space or retrieving them at all. And so anyway, then just another on the brighter side, regarding private space, I just saw a notice where Israel is putting up the first private lunar lander, and I didn't read much about it, but I think it's a good first step. But the other private space story that's in the news today, Spaceship Two is the orbital vehicle or suborbital vehicle, I should say, of Scaled Composites. This actually has morphed into Virgin Galactic, which is Richard Branson's investment into Burt Rutan's Scaled Composites and the Burt Rutan designs that they used to win the first X Prize, the Ansari X Prize. And so anyway, the White Knight 1 was the carrier vehicle. I do have some pictures of that. Maybe I'll be able to post some of them on the webpage here, that I took myself when I was at the Oshkosh Air Show, oh, maybe 10 years ago. I forget when that was. But after the Ansari X Prize, they flew the White Knight 1 and the Spaceship 1, which won the Ansari X Prize, flew it up to the Oshkosh Air Show, and Bert was there with his crew of people. And I met him briefly in San Diego long ago. It was in the mid-80s at the Airspace America Air Show, where I was an invited speaker talking about my space programs, etc., which, by the way, were absconded. my space programs were absconded by the U.S. Air Force, and that's why I know that there are other, let's say, activities going on in outer space that you never see, because I was the person that designed most of what they're doing. But they didn't like my attitude that I was against nuclear war and nuclear missiles, etc. But anyway, great work from the crew over there at the Mojave space, the spaceship 1 and 2, landing field, etc. This is their fourth flight. So they're narrowing down on the time when they can actually send tourists for $250,000 a pop to go up to the edge of space. And the word is, too, that they have sent equipment up. So they're not only sending people, but they can put equipment on there on their spaceship one and two or two, and actually take data for people, etc. So very interesting. And just another note, both Blue Horizon and SpaceX, two launch companies that are private, the SpaceX is Elon Musk's baby, both of them had launch setbacks, and these are timing setbacks due to technical difficulties, and so some of them dealing with military communication satellite launches, etc. But after I'm a person that works in the technical field also, not only theoretical, but anytime you do something technical, especially when you're flying, oh good grief, that's really difficult. So you would expect setbacks, and that's, as far as I'm concerned, normal. But when you're dealing with big equipment that's under a lot of pressure, etc., it's just really difficult to get everything to work right. And so setbacks, I'm amazed that some of these companies do as much as they do. But anyway, that's I don't consider setbacks with these private companies a major deal. And of course, NASA had its share of setbacks also in delays based on technical difficulties. So it's something that you would expect in that industry. Okay, so let me see. I'll just mention here about Saturn. There's a story that just came out. It was published in the Cornell Space Science Journal called Icarus. And by the way, Icarus was the mythological character who glued feathers onto his arms, and he wanted to fly. So he flew, and he got up too close to the sun, and the feathers melted off, and he fell to his death. That was Icarus. So anyway, the Space Science Journal at Cornell University is called Icarus, and they published an article stating that the Saturnian rings are going away. And the way they determined this was that there is a rain, what they were detecting actually was hydrogen, but in the form of water. And what they were detecting was rain coming in off the rings down to the planetary surface. And this is something that I talk about in my early work, that the rings are not a permanent fixture. And in fact, my paper, which you can read in the appendix of my book, Planet X, Comets and Earth Changes, it's called Saturn Sweeper Moons Predicted, I talk about the fact that the rings were not permanent, that they were a non-permanent fixture, and they had to be renewed. So this is basically the hydrogen wind that comes off the surface of Saturn goes out, and it comes back in the form of water. The hydrogen combines with oxygen, which is prevalent in the area. And so the rings are actually spirals. You can see that the rings are not continuous. They're not like a ring that goes around in one ring, then joins back with the same ring. They are in the spiraling in, like the old-fashioned 33 RPM records, the discs, the big discs or the smaller discs. And you put a needle on it, and you'd start out at the outside, and after it got done, the needle would move on to the inside. But anyway, that's the way the Saturn rings are. And so it was very clear that these rings were temporary and had to be renewed. So it's like, the brain dead NASA scientists, once again, can't figure out. And so what they do instead is they said, oh, well, in 100 million years, the rings will be gone. And we're seeing them at the middle of their lifetime. Well, they're supposed to be 4.5 billion years old. So how did they last this long? And then all of a sudden, they're going to end in 100 million years, which is a snippet of time compared to 4.5 billion years. So of course, it's all fairy tale, bubblegum science. Doesn't make any sense, but it gets published in the so-called respectable peer-reviewed journals. Okay, so, but tonight I want to talk about something very special. There are two new things. The farthest planet was discovered. This was in our own solar system. and that's estimated to have a diameter of around 310 miles. It's been seen many times in telescopes, and it's nicknamed, I don't think this will be its permanent name because astronomical names are typically given from Greek mythology or Roman mythology, but the temporary name is Far Out, F-A-R-O-U-T, is because it's the farthest planet, minor planet, discovered in our solar system. And it is four times the distance to Pluto. And so they don't know much about it. They believe it's round from the characteristics that, you know, you can tell if things are oblong or potato-shaped or round simply because they rotate and they give off something of a different pattern. But anyway, from the best they can determine, this object is round about 300 miles in diameter. Its orbit, they estimate, takes about 1,000 years to go around the sun. But there again, I don't know if they really have enough data yet to determine a real orbit for this object. And so anyway, there'll be more studies about this. But the reason they found this object is because the one of the automated search engines is looking for what they call Planet Nine. And that's a story in itself, because they demoted Pluto from being the ninth planet so that they could then search and not call it Planet X or Planet 10. And that's how strange the astronomical community is. That's how paranoid they are about calling something Planet X. So they demote Pluto. They've discovered hundreds of these minor planets out there, which are called typically called Kuiper Belt objects, to keep them from being called planets. But they're literally planets, a lot of them bigger than Pluto, and they're looking for something that has been allegedly moving these things around, so thus something big, you know, maybe Jupiter size or larger even, potentially. And, of course, at the same time, poo-pooing anybody that would suggest that there might be a 10th planet. But, you know, this double talk that comes out of the astronomy community, like their Planet X good, your Planet X bad. Anyway, the silliness doesn't get any sillier than that. But I'll try and come back and talk about this particular far-out planet in a few minutes. But what I find much more interesting is that remember the Pluto probe that went by Pluto a number of years ago, the New Horizons spacecraft, it came to the closest approach of about 50,000 miles away from Pluto. So that's, you know, like maybe in terms of Earth system, about one fifth of the way to the moon. So that's pretty close, and with good cameras, we've got very high resolution of what was going on in Pluto, in the atmosphere, etc. And so I'll talk about Pluto and some of its discoveries in just a few minutes. But that New Horizons spacecraft kept going, and they redirected it by a gravitational assist around Pluto, and now it's going to make a very close approach to a little object that has been known about for some time. It's called Ultima Thule, T-H-U-L-E. So Ultima is like a Latin word, and then Thule. But the object, they really don't know much about. It has kind of an irregular pattern of light that's given off. And so therefore they believe that it could be potato shape or oblong or some odd shape, but they don't know much about this. And the very interesting thing here is that when they got to Pluto, Pluto surprised them. Now, when I was a kid, the books, you know, not that they would be very accurate, but they said that Pluto would be the coldest planet. And, well, that would be very interesting. But then there was the question about the dark side of Mercury. Well, Mercury never, one side does not show its side to the sun. And just like our moon always shows us one side. So could it be that the dark side of Mercury is colder than Pluto? Because, there was, somewhat of a debate at the time. In fact, I was involved myself in a school classroom debate. And it really didn't get resolved. You know, there was no resolution, but it was very interesting that there were different points of view of what the coldest planet would be, that it could actually be Mercury, the closest planet to the sun, because one of its side did not rotate around to ever see the sun. Or could it be Pluto, which was out in the far hinterlands of the solar system? Well, it turns out that Pluto is the warmer planet. Very interesting that Pluto is actually warmer than Mercury. And so this was kind of a surprise. Plus, it has bubbling mountains of some kind of a nitrogen compounds mixed with water. So the water creates a structure, but these are systems that are forming. There's actual weather on Pluto. You could see the snow falling into the atmosphere coming from the outside. You could see Pluto, the atmosphere, from a distance. You could see the cometary coma, both around planet Pluto and its moon Charon, which is literally a small planet in its own right, but locked in orbit around Pluto. They're in a kind of co-orbit, you might say, because Charon is not that much smaller than Pluto. But there are mountains on Pluto that are about 11,000 feet tall. So those are big mountains. On Earth, that would be a pretty sizable mountain. The kind that, what are some comparisons? There's some volcanoes. Well, there's many mountains on Earth that are easily 11,000 feet tall above sea level. But Pluto having mountains that are in the state of development is a very interesting issue. It's very clear that Pluto has an internal energy source. And if it were sitting there for 4.5 billion years, certainly it would not be active like this. So something else is going on. Once again, space scientists are grappling for concepts to try and explain what obviously contradicts everything that they believe about the solar system. They're still talking about Pluto being 4.5 billion years old. They're talking about Saturn being 4.5 billion years old. And what I was going to mention about Cornell is that my paper actually was submitted to the Cornell Journal there. And this story you can read about online. But its editor at the time, the true editor was Carl Sagan, but its sit-in editor was a guy named Joe Burns. And I still have the letter he wrote, and he said, well, there's no need to assume anything about the rings of Saturn because they're leftover remnants of the solar system 4.5 billion years ago. Well, you know, that was the nursery rhyme, which still exists today, but which could not possibly be true. Because if something's going to last 4.5 billion years, then it's certainly going to last for the next 4.5 billion years. And that's clearly not the case. So now they're trying to slip slide around that issue of Saturn's rings. But clearly Pluto does not fit the mold of something that's 4.5 billion years old. And just sitting out there in deep space, you have to remember that if you were at Pluto and you turned around and looked at the sun would be the equivalent of about another star. The sun would be just a brighter than average star. It would be like a little speck of light out there, and certainly not giving you enough heat energy in any way, shape, or form to cause any heat to be assimilated by the planet. The planet would certainly be giving off more heat than it would receive, and then over time just become this icy ball, and the atmosphere would crystallize and fall down to the surface, but Pluto has an atmosphere. It has snow. It has mountain building. It has activity. In fact, on my picture of the day subpage, you can see an image of, I call it a milk boil, and that's literally what it is, but it's a boiling a liquid, a very thick liquid, that produces the same form as the mountains on Pluto. And so you can see that picture, you can see the photos, and hopefully I'll have these photos of Pluto posted on my homepage here. So hopefully I'll have the these photos of Pluto posted so you can take a look at them, and then hopefully have the picture also reposted of the milk boil comparing my experiment basically with an internal heat source showing how this bubbling, oozing mass forms these shapes and the way the mountainous regions of Pluto have formed. But very interesting that, you know, the entire idea that Pluto was somehow this icy cold planet simply is not true. And it is not the coldest planet in the solar system. It is not. Mercury, it turns out, and by the way, that was my side of the debate in, oh, what grade was that? It was, you know, maybe fourth grade. And it turns out that after all these years, I was right. Not that there was enough information at the time then to make that determination, but it turns out that I was right, that Pluto is not the coldest planet in the solar system. Very interesting. But where does that energy come from? And that's the question. But the real answer is that in that region out there, that is still part of the solar capacitor. And what happens is the material is coming in. It's Pluto is discharging the solar capacitor. And you could see the cometary activity, the plasma discharge comet model, acting. You could see the tails swooshing around Pluto and Charon in the video clips. And these are like intermittent photos is what they are, but they blend them into a video clip, a time-lapse video clip. And you could see the tail swooshing around Pluto and its moon Charon. And so they are discharging the solar capacitor. They have abundant material, primarily nitrogen and oxygen and hydrogen out there. And so that's where these compounds come from that are very, very cold. You know, when we talk about cold, they're liquid down to very low temperatures. So and it's kind of a combination of ice water, and nitrogen-hydrogen compounds mixed together to form this very cold but somewhat fluid material that is very active on the planet Pluto. And plus you see this influx of material coming in. So with that discharge of the solar capacitor, that's where the energy comes from. And also Pluto may not be that old. I doubt if it's 4.5 billion years old, but the photo, there's a photo on the cover of my homepage, if you scroll down on the left side, it's known as the Owl Nebula. And you can see this activity around another star. You can see the comets that are out there forming, and this is where the Kuiper Belt objects come from. So getting back to the object out there, Ultima Thule, that, by the way, it's going to be, we'll have pictures, they say, by New Year's. It's supposed to pass by this object, the New Horizons spacecraft, is supposed to pass by the object Ultima Thule 4 times farther than Pluto. It's supposed to pass it on New Year's Day, coming up here, a couple week away. And, or 2 weeks, I'm sorry, I'm exaggerating. But a couple short weeks away. and then the time it transmits to some of those pictures back. But we'll have pictures of an object that's out in the Kuiper Belt, four times the distance to Pluto, in a few short days here. And I just wonder if NASA is going to doctor the photos or hold them back. I remember one time I was on Coast to Coast AM. It was July 15th, it's 4th of July, and I can't remember the year offhand. It's posted on my webpage. But NASA had a probe that was going by a spacecraft, and it was the Deep Impact spacecraft, and they were supposed to show live the photos that night. It was a big pre-planned thing. It was supposed to be the big splash. It was going to be NASA's gift to us on 4th of July. I was on Coast to Coast AM with George Norrie. We're waiting for the photos to come in, and no photos. And this was held back by Goddard Space Flight Center, who was in charge of that data. And then we waited and waited, and months later, the data was finally released, showing no water, no snow, or no ice, and a little poof of dust coming off the nucleus of the comet. No water, no snow, or ice coming out of the discharge. But NASA hid the data. They were supposed to release it. They were supposed to release it on July 4th, but they did not, because it would have been egg all over their face. And we knew that the data was not commensurate with the NASA Dirty Snowball Comet model. And besides that, there was an electrical spark, literally, which I had predicted, because you send this spacecraft into the environment of the comet, it's going to discharge the local capacitor around the comet and create a discharge, which it did. So all of the predictions that I made came true. But like I say, NASA held the data. They sat on it and didn't release it for a number of months. So the point being, will that happen on the first of the year here, first of the year 2019? Is NASA going to sit on this data and not release it or doctor it, or who knows exactly what might go on? But just exactly what might this object look like? Well, it's in a region also where it could be discharging the solar capacitor. So I think more importantly than a close-up photos would be the photos as this object is approached by the spacecraft. And those photos are probably being taken already. So those are the interesting photos, just like with Pluto, where you would see the object from a distance and see the cometary activity, the very distinct cometary coma cloud around this object as the spacecraft approached. And it's very capable of taking those kind of photographs, those very sensitive photographs, because it did so at Pluto. And so, you know, Pluto not really being much bigger. Now, there's another set of issues in that when you talk about an atmosphere, and this is a basic physics problem that if you've taken basic physics, rigorous basic physics, you probably have at least touched on this problem. And that is how large an atmosphere could be held by a given planetary object, given a certain mass and its radius, etc. The question is, you set the problem up like this. You take the radius of the planet and its mass, and that gives you the surface gravity. And then also you can calculate the gravitational force on the atmosphere that would extend out from the planetary surface. Okay, now you take the temperature of the air, and of course there's a profile. It's warmer, air is warmer near the planetary surface, and it gets colder as you get up higher. And so you have to look at the temperature profile of the gas that's up higher. And what happens is there's a velocity distribution. And there's a peak of this velocity distribution based on the temperature of the gas. in that peak gets lower and lower as you, based on the temperature. If the temperature of the gas is lower, that peak is lower. But what happens is there's a tail, a mathematical tail that goes out to basically to infinity. And so no matter what temperature your atmosphere is at, you're going to have some particles that have very high velocity. And those particles escape because they're up at the surface. They have high velocity. It's enough velocity to escape the gravitational pull of the planet. And that is a well-known number based on the gravity and the radius of the planet, etc. And so you can calculate the rate of loss of atmosphere of this object, this hypothetical object, and how much time it would take for the atmosphere to completely dissipate it into outer space. And turns out that smaller objects like Pluto, the surface gravity is pretty low, very, very low. And so it would, there's two factors. The other one is that below a certain temperature, the chemicals in the atmosphere, the gases in the atmosphere, would crystallize and fall down to the ground. And so you have out at Pluto two factors that would eliminate its atmosphere in very short order. But it turns out that Pluto's atmosphere is actually growing. It's growing because you can see the layers of snow, and when I say snow, it's not like Earth snow necessarily, but it's a combination of the nitrogen, hydrogen, oxygen molecules snowing and coalescing or creating these molecules. And because the planet is big enough, when these chemicals come into the upper atmosphere, they settle down and drift down to the planetary surface. So Pluto is growing all of the time, and that's part of its constant, the heat that's being generated is through this, the discharge of the solar capacitor, even though it's way out away from the sun. And so Pluto has some energy input into its equation, but if Pluto had been there for 4.5 billion years, all by itself, all by its little lonesome, and subject to the processes of evaporation of the upper end of the velocity distribution curve of the atmosphere going away, and then of the colder part crystallizing and falling down to the surface, Pluto would not have an atmosphere. But it does. Now we're getting to an object that's much smaller. Ultima Thule, this object that the New Horizons spacecraft is just about to arrive at, is way below the threshold of anything that could hold an atmosphere. So if all of a sudden the NASA New Horizons spacecraft comes along and sees this object, Ultima Thule, with an atmosphere and atmospheric conditions and weather as is going on Pluto, then they have a big, big problem. Because they're, and this is basic physics. We're not talking amazing discoveries. We're not talking something new that they could discover that would keep atmosphere around a small object. There's nothing out there. And in terms of, say, Dirty Snowball Comet model activity where the sunlight would reach it and somehow warm it up and cause stuff to come off the nucleus. There again, if this had been going on for 4.5 billion years, there wouldn't be anything left out there. This thing would be, sublimated away, and there wouldn't be anything left to see. There wouldn't be a Ultima Thule left. And if there were, it would just be a piece of rock, so not an object. But the other thing is, it's very well known that it's well within the orbital limits of Jupiter that the Dirty Snowball Comet thing can work. And that's, once again, contradicted by this K2 comet that's coming into the solar system. Also, the comet Hale-Bopp, which exploded into brightness far out in the solar system, far away from the limit to under which the Dirty Snowball Comet model works. But this object is so far out there that NASA cannot, in its wildest dreams, somehow invoke a solar created, energized sublimation process that could cause an atmosphere. Just couldn't happen. And so the end result is that I'm expecting they will find an atmosphere. In fact, they're already talking about it. Well, they have to, because they have to prime the pump, so to speak, the fake science news, fake information pump. They have to prime it so that they don't look completely stupid when they get out there and they go, oh, this is sure amazing, and we'll have to work and get our brightest top scientists working on this so we can figure out how some object that's supposedly been there for 4.5 billion years could be doing this. Well, of course, then they'll go into hiding, and 6 months later, they'll publish some piece of, well, you know what, in Icarus, which will rubber stamp publish it, because it's not an honorable, respectable journal. It's a rubber stamp to protectionism for the standard scientific baloney that they try and pawn off on you, the public. But every time a space probe comes near a new object in outer space, every time a space probe gets new information, it blatantly contradicts these standard theories. But remember, this is tier two science. These are the tier two scientists that don't have a life, that have a job at Goddard or at JPL or Los Alamos. A lot of the guys there, women, are tier two scientists that have to maintain this routine. And they get their paychecks and work towards retirement because they maintain this garbage science. And it's just an expense of the banker community to have phony science that then is promulgated to you, the public. But this will be a very, very interesting New Year's because of that. And my guess is NASA will not release the data. That is my guess. They're going to have to sit on it, doctor it, massage it, blend it, homogenize it, purify it, pasteurize it before it gets to you. Okay, so with that in mind and talking about comets and what comets really are and the fact that there are hundreds of planetary comets out there, planets that are in formation in the formation from cometary activity, the plasma discharge comet model, let's switch to the cometary topic of Christmas, where the season we are right now. And remember that the three kings saw a star with a tail in the sky. Well, pretty much, whether it was at the time of Christ's birth or whether it's now, a star with a tail is a comet. And the comets are a very specific phenomenon in the sky. Now, the other thing was that, remember that the three kings lived in totally different countries. And they saw in the heavens something that they knew had been predicted thousands of years earlier. Okay, so they were watching for this. So this was a very specific comet with very specific characteristics. It wasn't just an average comet, because these people were watchers of the sky. They watched, they knew the heavens, they knew all about them, and they knew that the prediction was for this very special comet. And I've speculated, this is speculation, is that the comet was a three-headed comet. In other words, there were three celestial objects, three nuclei in this comet. Or it was something so very special that would make it completely unique, something in orbital period or something that made this comet very special, and that's the sign they had been waiting for. So these guys all independently packed their bags, and this is something I've always said, that the three kings, there was not one, there was not two, there were three kings, all looking for the same thing in different countries. They didn't have cell phones. They didn't have satellite communication. They all saw this and recognized it for what it was. This was the sign in the heavens that the Magi, that the Savior, was nigh, that the time was nigh. So they packed their entourage of food and people. Now they were traveling across unknown lands to them. They were leaving their country, and they met along the way. They joined because they were following this star. Now, understand the very intricate story here, that they discovered the star, the Christmas star was discovered in the east, but they followed it to the west. And that's very characteristic of a comet that has crossed around behind the sun. Now, the atheist, anti-God astronomy community would like you to believe that this was a planetary alignment. Well, planetary alignments last a number of hours, and there's many, many of them. They're very common. There are planetary alignments that happen every year. So there's nothing unusual about a planetary alignment at all. And so it's not something that would rock your boat as a king watching the stars to pack up all of your bags and head off into the distance with your entourage. And remember, these people could probably only cover maybe about 10 miles a day at most. And, you know, then they'd have to set up camp and fix food, and they had people carrying things and everything they needed for this long, arduous trip, this very difficult trip. And then they meet along the way, and they discuss it, and they go, yeah, we're following the star there. So they go together for safety. But this is an incredible story. This is one of the most interesting stories because, like I say, it's not one king, not two, but three. And if it were one, you'd go, yeah, okay, it was just, okay, he was following some star. He thought, you know, two guys, well, maybe, you know, just, you know, chance. But three kings, no. That three kings in totally independent countries saw this, packed the bags, started moving. And remember, they didn't have Ferraris and four-lane highways. This was open country, and it probably took them 6 months or maybe the better part of a year to follow this star and finally come upon the birthplace of Christ. And so this was happening before Christ was born. And they came upon the manger, etc., the humble beginnings of the, you know, the Christmas story. And that was a cold night. There was no room for them at the inn. And the star came to rest above the birthplace, the manger, the little place out in the countryside where there was nothing. And the only thing they had were some leftover rags, and that's what the baby Jesus was born with. So, you know, those humble beginnings, and it's a very beautiful story for a person that came out and finally told the human race, this is the way you should be living, and that's the real story. And then, of course, what they did to him in the end was because he was teaching something that took the working population off their job. What he finally, his demise was the short time before he threw the money changers out of the temple. He was making the wealthy people of that time very angry because he was, remember the Sermon on the Mount from the Mount of Olives, and he talked about the end days. And that's a story that the people in the monetary economic world don't want you to understand. The reason they don't want you to understand it is because if the population woke up in mass, and realized that, hey, this could all end one day through natural disasters or something. The government would not be able to help us. Economy would not be able to help us. Having money stored up would not be able to help us. The only thing that's going to help us is our ability to take care of ourselves. And that is the message. In fact, it comes out over and over again, the message of Christ, in that, you know, he talks about the birds, you know, hey, don't worry about it. But what does the evening news tell you? Oh, the economy, worry about this, worry about Russia, worry about China, worry about the Middle East, worry about oil, worry about your housing payment, your insurance, you know, etc. That's what the evening news is all about, to keep you and your family from ever imagining that you could live as free people. You know, and that's, you know, so when they start out at Thanksgiving and the birth of the country of the United States, the freest country on the world, in the planet, it's got some problems, but it's the freest, best country on the planet that has ever existed. And they take the Thanksgiving, which was the birth of the country, and turn it into the biggest shopping day of the year, and then build that up to Christmas, the biggest shopping spree of the year, and replace Jesus with Santa Claus, and replace Easter with a bunny that lays colored eggs. They pretty much have destroyed Christian culture, destroyed the family, etc. So it's very important to understand that from the very beginning, comets were involved in the Noah's flood, in the Moses event. And when Christ talks about the end days, he describes a comet. He says, look up in the heavens, look for the signs. The meteor showers is what he's talking about, when the stars would seem to fall from the heaven. That's the meteor streams. These are all symbols of comets. And that's the one thing that everybody out there, including the Pope, doesn't want you to think about. This has all been removed from religion, from the lectures, etc. It's all been removed, and especially with the economic world. So just remember that Christmas is a very special time of year. Keep it as simple as you can. Of course, I love getting presents. I love to give presents to people, but the end result is that Christmas is a time for family, time to get together, have a good time, and, you know, just be together, be happy together. So once again, this is Jim McCanney. We'll talk to you after Christmas. This is my Science Hour. And as always, we are at the crossroads. Good night.